Hadi bakalım. Hey everybody, welcome back to Human Reaction. I'm David Rand here with Kyle Mack and Bennett. We are sans our most handsome redhead. He's out trolling the world, selling waffles, I believe, is what he's doing today. So we're going to be talking about the Epstein files. Kyle, you got a sweet meme to kick us off?
Yeah, so the Epstein files came out and the internet was kind of lukewarm on everything. And here's a RFK's take. Everyone, and then we have phase one.
Like eating a cheeseburger when you're running for
McDonald's. Yeah. He's got that kind of look on his face, like, what did I get myself into?
If you are a small business owner looking for exponential growth, you have to connect with Adam Thune at Intellectual Patriots. He will revolutionize your business game and help you get to the next level. Adam can streamline your business practices and advertising strategies to improve your bottom line. His expertise in data engineering means he can build you the systems you need to collect and analyze market data. His mission is to provide you with invaluable insights to fuel your success. From grant writing and business proposals to digital systems integrations, even AI management, Intellectual Patriots is a one-stop shop for cutting-edge solutions. Don't wait another second. Visit intelpatriots.com to learn more. That's I-N-T-E-L patriots.com. This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
But yeah, so the Epstein files phase one released this week, and coming from Pam Bondi and Kash Patel, there's a bunch of, there was kind of a whole situation that went on with the, there was like a group of influencers that were seen at the White House, and they had these kind of prop binders, and the internet is very not satisfied with what we've gotten so far in phase one.
Mitt Romney's binders?
They're not binders full of women, Bennett.
Yeah, they have just, no women in them. They just got black boxes.
just underage people.
Yeah, just entirely redacted is really what it is. Really what it is. But that being said, with it, because what came out in the phase one here was essentially just a bunch of information we already had. We had the client list. Not the client list. There, it was the contact list, which is separate from the client list. Mm-hmm. And there was like the flight logs, but all of this information was already there. But what the real kind of bombshell, I guess you could say, was this letter from Attorney General Pam Bondi to Kash Patel. Mm-hmm. And I want to read that for you guys, because this is something that I feel like is not getting enough. Like,
literally the first I'm hearing about it.
Yeah, so. Like everybody's just kind of, the whole story is just like, oh, they just released a bunch of information that we already knew. Oh, it's kind of a fake investigation or whatever. Like that's kind of what the vibe is on the internet. Mm-hmm. But I want to read this letter from Pam Bondi to Director Patel, and you can kind of see where the real bombshell probably is. Is we have, actually here, let me adjust this here. That makes it way easier. So dear Director Patel, before you came into office, I requested the full and complete files related to Jeffrey Epstein. In response to this request, I received approximately 200 pages of documents, which consisted primarily of flight logs, Epstein's list of contacts, and a list of victims' names and phone numbers. I repeatedly questioned whether this was the full set of documents responsive to my request and was repeatedly assured by the FBI that we had received the full set of documents. Late yesterday, I learned from a source that the FBI field office in New York was in possession of thousands of pages of documents related to the investigation and indictment of Epstein. Despite my repeated requests, the FBI never disclosed the existence of these files. When you and I spoke yesterday, you were just as surprised as I was to learn the new information. By 8 a.m. tomorrow, February 28th, so it's this morning, The FBI will deliver the full and complete Epstein files to my office, including all records, documents, audio, and video recordings and materials related to Jeffrey Epstein and his clients, regardless of how much information was obtained. There will be no withholdings or limitations to my or your access. The Department of Justice will ensure that any public disclosure of these files will be done in a manner to protect the privacy of victims and in accordance with the law. As I have done my entire career as prosecutor, I am also directing you to conduct an immediate investigation into why my order to the FBI was not followed. You will deliver to me a comprehensive report of your findings and proposed personnel action within 14 days. I appreciate your immediate attention to the important matter, yada, yada. But that's kind of the important thing here is what we're seeing here is that we have the Southern District of New York, which is kind of known for being not great.
you don't say.
Withholding, according to Pam Bondi, through a source that came out of the Southern District, that they've been withholding thousands of documents to the Epstein case from her office.
Is that the same one that got Trump on all his felonies? Or was that...
I'm not sure the connections there, but it's one of those things where I wouldn't felonies. Be... like. I it's one of those things where if we did a search on it, we would probably find something there, right?
Is that the one that killed
probably
the squirrel?
Probably checks out. Just don't open those.
So, because right now, that's kind of what we've had right now is like the internet's in this uproar of just like, oh my God, they just gave a bunch of binders as props for this publicity stunt and nothing's really been had here. And Pam Bondi lied to us. There's nothing there, yada, yada, yada. But like, that's not really the story as I see it. The story as I see it is the FBI is in a civil war right now, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think what's really going on as far as the culture on this is the folks on the right have been needing a diet of white pills for a solid 2 months now. And they got their first dose of actual resistance and challenge and disappointment. And so now they're kind of taking it out on the influencers. You got to have a little sympathy for them. You know, I'm sure they just got handed a binder. No time to know what's in it. Went outside to take a little, hey, we got these neato binders. And now they're, you know, look like goofballs. Quite a few other people kind of stepped out like most transparent president ever, you know, on the announcement before we realized.
That was the funny thing. Actually, I have some tweets here because some of the influencers. So it was a distribution of binders to 15 conservative influencers. Some of the more high profile ones that people have probably heard are DC Drano, big Twitter account. The woman Chaya Reichick from Libs of TikTok. You had Mike Cernovich, Liz Wheeler, Jack Posobiec. You know, it is an interesting cast of characters that we're getting here because a lot of these people haven't necessarily been super involved in the Epstein case. Cernovich, he's really the only one that I would say has been highly involved in Epstein for a period of time. Everybody else, you know, it's kind of like, I feel like there could have been maybe a better choice of influencers, I could say. But
maybe some more serious, investigative reporters, or if you got Schellenberger and Taibbi in there, then people would be, I think, taken a little more seriously.
Or like Whitney Webb. She's the one that wrote the book, right?
Yeah, right.
Like that'd probably be a useful one. But something that you were kind of referencing there, Dave, was there was kind of this copy pasta that went on of these Twitter influencers. Today, I met with President Trump, VP J.D. Vance, AG Pam Bondi, and FBI Director Kash Patel in the Oval Office. They handed me a binder copy of the Epstein files. And then you see like from Chad Prather, it's like literally the same message. So there is a little bit of part of the critique that's going on right now is like these people are just kind of the Trump press corps now. And you know, there's kind of that aspect to it that like it's a photo op. It is what it is. Yeah. Some other areas of concern is, you know, this group as a whole, pretty heavily Zionist. With what we know about Epstein, for anybody that's paid attention to the Epstein case, there's a lot of fingerprints from Mossad that are all over this as a likely Mossad op. There's some noticing maybe to be had there.
Is Cernovich associated with Zionism in a serious way? I'm not aware.
Cernovich, he actually had an interesting tweet thread a few months back, I remember, where he had made a comment at one point where he was finding it extremely difficult to defend Israel on a bunch of stuff. And he basically said that his support of Israel in general is much more of just like a power politics stuff, rather than like an ideological framework, okay. Which is interesting. And it's also like Jack Posobiec, he's a little bit more balanced on the whole Israel dialogue than I would say some of these other characters are. Like DC Drano and Chaya Raichik, like they're pretty heavily there. And it's just one of those things where like we have the fingerprints of Mossad. For anybody that's paid attention, even since before Jeffrey Epstein died, like the Maxwell connections to Mossad are so clearly there. And it, when you have kind of these like ardent defenders of Israel, it becomes, it's going to be cloudy on the judgment, I would say. And that's maybe an area of concern to be had with this group. But, you know, I think that there's some patience that are is maybe worth being warranted in this whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, we're still just over a month into his presidency. When you think about it, like we're 5 weeks in. Yeah. So I think he's, you know, given how quickly everything's happened and all the executive orders, I'm okay being a little bit more patient. And it's not like we'd even be having this conversation if it were, say, Kamala Harris in office. So this would never even, it would just be swept under the rug forever.
There would be no binders.
Yeah.
At least we have binders.
No binders, no photo ops. Binders.
Hey, man, those binders are going to be collector's items in no time. It's going to be really important. They'd be like, these were the binders. They're going to go on Amazon for thousands of dollars. I promise you.
They're going to be in the old FBI museum that Cashman has.
Yeah, here actually, I got a video clip from Savannah Hernandez, which was one of the people that got the binders, and you can kind of get her take on this, and then we can maybe go into the cases for optimism and maybe some cases for pessimism. I think that there's room for both. Maybe some caution is worthy being warranted in all of this.
Yeah.
But here is a clip from her talking about like having just received the binder.
Ben Hernandez in front of the White House with, yes, one of those Epstein file binders. Now, I want to clear something up immediately and state that nobody from the Trump admin gave us these binders and said, you guys are going to be the ones responsible for disseminating this information. They actually told us that there's going to be a press conference at any moment now, most likely this afternoon, in which all of the information in this binder is made available to the American public. Now, Pam this morning stated to us that some of the information in here is already public, and she doesn't really feel that any of this information is a smoking gun. The big story here is Pam writing a letter to Kash Patel asking him to investigate why the FBI has stopped the release of other portions of the Epstein files. So that is what is currently going on. And I wanted to come out as a journalist as well and state that, again, we are not responsible for deciding what does or does not come out. All of the information in this binder will be made public. Pam Bondi herself stated that she wants all of the Epstein files to be made public to the American people, not just to influencers or independent journalists, but that in itself has been a process. And now, one of the reasons why I have this is because the Trump admin right now is making a big push for not only transparency, but being welcoming to independent journalists who might have been looked down on, ignored, or even censored over the last 4 years. This administration is making a big push right now to allow American people to come into the Oval Office, to come into the White House and directly talk to the president, the vice president, Kash Patel, Pam Bondi, RFK Jr. about what they... Okay.
I'm going to stop it there, but you kind of get the vibe. Yeah, there's a little bit more of the messaging stuff that's going on there, but yeah. So how do you guys feel about the phase one rollout so far?
I can't wait for phase four in the Avengers. I mean, I don't know.
You know, of course, Cash Strikes Back.
Yeah, yeah. Endgame.
Multiverse series going on here.
I mean, like we just said, like it's a start. So I'll take it. And, you know, if it's just like constantly this along the way, then I think we'll be highly critical. But as of right now, I'm optimistic, cautiously optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like,
yeah,
I just, oh yeah, go ahead, Dave.
No, I was just going to say there's a, there's an understanding disappointment here that I think people feel rightfully like the rug was pulled out from under them. I imagine these influencers probably feel worse than anybody on it. On the other side of it, I think there is a there's wisdom in the fear of a attempt by the Trump administration to co-opt members of the independent media so that they can get better coverage. Those folks, independent journalists and influencers, if you will, I think have a responsibility to their audiences and to the American people to make sure that doesn't happen, to make sure that they remain independent and critically thinking about what the Trump administration is doing, not just saying, but doing, and attempting to actually hold accountable the powerful, which should be the appropriate job for journalism.
Well, that there isn't, there's a bit of an access game that's going on here where the influencers that are going to be getting in this information, they're going to want to do kind of the press corps, give the talking points in order for them to continue to get their access, because that is where the dollars come from. You know, there is a bit of that that is maybe subject for concern. But also that being said, you don't necessarily want to throw these things, throw these this types of information directly to kind of unfriendly journalists, I guess. Like, there's also that. But part of the concern online was a lot of people, I think, were expecting just a open source dump of everything right off the bat, which actually we do kind of have. It is in the press release. Like, all the information that's in the binders is effectively here. I just, like, if I clicked on any of these links, you see, but like I said, all of this information is things that we already had. Like, these are things that were like leaked to Gawker back in the day. Like, we've had this years ago. But that being said, too, Pam Bondi said in the release of these that you shouldn't expect any major bombshells in phase one. That's not what's to be expected in phase one. And she kind of rolled that out as a precursor to all of this. And then everybody's just like, why don't we have every bit of information ever in phase one? But they also put out the letter where it's like, the FBI has been withholding information.
Yeah, that's right. The part that I was just going to come back to, which... Again, it's like this. I have not been paying attention to any of this. So hearing about her letter to Cash, yeah, I feel like you said, that's more the story right now.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. This they is just spiked the football at the wrong time.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the publicity stunt is where the kind of the problem was, because it kind of undercut everything.
Well, I feel like everyone felt a similar way with the JFK, RFK, MLK files. It's like, wait, we're not just getting them all like just released? And it's like it's a little bit
Well, and there's this internet dynamic that's going on right now where you have, and it's the same cast of characters that it always is, trying to sow division amongst the America firsters. Like, they're the same people that are trying to purge out Elon Musk out of the movement. They're the same people that went after Vivek. They're the same people. Like, it's all the same people. And they're the ones that are like kind of quasi turning on Trump, but they're doing it in like a loyalist way where it's like, he needs better vetting of who is getting into these positions. And like, they're doing this kind of game right here. And my conspiracy alarms are going off with these people where, like, it's sort of, when all this stuff happened,
they're on another list. The next Epstein.
They're on the next. We said in the very beginnings of this, after Trump was elected, is that there's going to be a lot of division that is thrown in here to kind of splinter the movement apart, do a divide and conquer strategy. And I'm watching it happen online right now, and it's like very specific influencers are kind of setting their followers in such a way where they're sending their followers to attack all these other people. And that chaos there is actually more beneficial for the people that really don't want the Epstein stuff released. It seems to me, that's how it feels like. It seems either game theoretically retarded to be doing this and trying to sow all this division, or
brilliant,
or it is quite beneficial to certain types of people when that happens. It makes me question things in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this could just be a communications debacle at the end of the day. That could be most of it. It was just, we spiked the ball at the wrong time. We sort of spiked this on phase two with the, you know, influencer binder thing with the press conferences. It should have been, here's phase one. There's a there's very little here. This is everything you guys already have, but we're just starting out with what we have. There's all these missing documents. Here's the letter. If that was phase one, it would have looked, I think, very reasonable, and people would be just, they wouldn't have this kind of moment. But because of the communications plan being bad, it looks rife. You know, I mean, it looks especially, what's the word? It looks especially conspiratorial that there's more going on here, or that there's a reason to be disappointed in the Trump administration so far.
It's maybe worth mentioning too, something that is like maybe easy to quickly gloss over is Dan Bongino came in as the deputy director of the FBI under Kash Patel, which is also interesting. Yeah. In this,
I don't remember if I think it was actually a Dave Smith episode because Robbie made a bald joke, so I just assumed that was Dave making the bald joke. So I was like, wait, did we talk about this?
You assume one bald is the other is our bald. Yeah,
they're all the same.
But there is a clip going around of Dan Bongino when he was on Timcast where he was talking about the Epstein stuff. I don't have it queued up, but I'll just kind of paraphrase it. And it is kind of interesting where Dan Bongino is just like, well, according to my sources, it appears that Epstein was some op or some asset for someone in the Middle East. I don't know who. you're just like, I don't know who. you're just like Iran,
obviously.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I'm worried about. Is I'm so worried that we're just going to end up getting super propagandized of being like, oh, Epstein was an Iran guy. That's what it was. And it's like when all the evidence points to one particular entity at this point in time. But. But Dan Bongino, he's a good guy, so I kind of don't mind him. I don't mind seeing him as deputy director at the FBI under Kash Patel. Like, he's been a pretty good guy on trying to fight a lot of this stuff.
Do we have any realistic expectation that we're going to see a Mossad finger pointing release? Like a very clear smoking gun?
Zero. Absolute zero.
I just don't. Well, and as of this time, so 8 o'clock this morning, 8 o'clock Eastern time, was when the FBI was demanded to bring all the files over to Pam Bondi's office. And as of right now, there's been no confirmation that that has actually occurred. I suspect that it's going to take a long time for that to actually occur. And who's to say a lot of these things might be destroyed?
I kind of think they are.
Allegedly, they have thousands of documents. Allegedly, because
the Daily Mail, right? The Daily Mail article that I've talked about a couple times that suggests that the FBI tapes went missing. You know what happened there? That's an investigation on itself. That'll take months.
Yeah. Is that the one that they like left the tapes at the mansion and went back a couple days later and they were gone?
Yeah, that's
the most fucking absolute bullshit thing of this entire.
I don't know. They just disappeared. They just disappeared, guys. I don't know.
Yeah,
that's so fucking annoying.
That was at the New York residence, right? And so we have other residences, right? We have somewhere out west. There's a res obviously in the Virgin Islands. So there's, you know, that might not be the only tapes. There might be that they have other tapes in possession. And I don't expect that we'll see those tapes released at, you know, maybe transcripts where there's relevant dialogue if we're very lucky. But, you know, that's very unlikely for protecting victims and stuff like that, too.
Another criticism I've seen laid out online is that because Epstein did a lot in Florida, he had a Florida residence as well. And
Well,
all this was going on with Epstein originally, Pam Bondi was the AG of Florida during that time. And there is a question there of like, why weren't you super like engaged at that time? Probably, I'm seeing that internet criticism going forward.
If I had the Stream Deck right now, I'd probably be pressing the don't be suspicious.
But
what I don't remember. Correct me if I'm wrong here. I thought there was a different prosecutor on his case, though. Maybe it was the county prosecutor or something like that. It was the guy that said that the reason why he didn't pursue the prosecution further was because Epstein was connected to intelligence.
Yeah. That was a different prosecutor. You are correct about that. But yeah, this is kind of where the division is being sown right now in internet space right now is these types of allegations being it's not an allegation. It's like a critique, right? But it really, again, it goes into the to me, where I'm sitting at is like, I'm sitting at a be patient and be careful with where your favorite influencer is trying to point you in this direction. There's areas to maybe have subjective concern. And as those concerns continue to rise, be more thoughtful on those. Mm-hmm. And then there's other areas where it's like, you know, just be patient, have some cautious optimism, but optimism.
I'm kind of similar to after the first assassination attempt on Trump. We were like, we're going to need to like wait to hear what's actually going on. Because it's like right away you hear everything and you're like, I don't know what to believe. So I think it's sort of similar to that. It's just like we're going to have to, you know, be a little bit more patient than everyone wants to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like all the Twitter drama, I think is just going to dilute the process. It's going to bog it down.
Yeah, I've been staying off there for a little bit.
Well, and it like
if, but it's if, there's if, a perverse incentive there, right, Kyle?
Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I was just gonna say there's a perverse incentive there, Kyle, because a lot of these rival influencers, they want to drag down the other people so that they can increase their viewership. And but there's also just good faith, like criticism of people kind of unquestionably doing the talking points of the administration. Right. So there's going to be good and bad faith ways of approaching this and bad motivations and that bog it down sometimes unintentionally. And sometimes, I mean, perhaps, and we should be open to the idea that it's intentional. Right. If you were going to put in an agent provocateur on the right wing, you'd make him an influencer.
Yep. And there's probably a lot of those going around right now. And any final thoughts on the Epstein phase one? Unfortunately, it is kind of just like we're really just waiting on phase two because there's nothing really new that exists there. But
I don't want to call it a nothing burger, but it's just like they did exactly what they said. And I don't know why people are upset about it.
It really is, to me, the story is the civil war that's going on.
Yeah.
Is that you have people directly disobeying orders from the executive branch. And that's that's the story to me. We should expect that. The deep state is the deep state.
The
right?
story to me is this letter to the FBI from Bondi.
Yeah.
I think that's more telling.
Yeah. And that's also to be like, Cash Patel's only been in there a week.
Yeah.
He's got some like figuring things out to do, especially with his own agency. This is all coming in from his own agency.
I think he's going to figure out who, like where he has loyalty. And that's going to be a big thing for him to figure out.
And noting, you know, this could be very embarrassing for the FBI. We know that Epstein was accused and perhaps confirmed as a as an FBI asset or at least an informant. So, you know, if there was a direct relationship between the FBI and these things, it makes sense why any individual who might have access could be implicated or, you know, the institution itself be implicated and they're protecting the institution.
I was scanning through some of the PDFs, actually, and I did come across there was a section. I wish I had like a screenshot of it right now where it was talking about exactly that aspect, Dave, where it was like all circled in there, where it was talking about it was talking about how he was an FBI asset of some sort and to kind of get rid of the prosecution on him. There was a section in one of the documents that talked about that. We'll see as this kind of keeps going. Another area that has happened here, and it's kind of just this is another thing we'll probably have more confirmation today on where this is heading. But the Supreme Court has kind of saved Trump on the USAID stuff that's been going on. Trump's been getting a lot of legal challenges. There's 22 states and a bunch of nonprofits that have sued the Trump administration for his executive order specifically, which was the reevaluating and realigning United States foreign aid. This was the executive order where he had the 90-day pause on foreign assistance, USAID, etc. And Trump has been sued. And there was a district judge, Amir Ali of Washington, D.C., who issued a temporary restraining order ruling the blanket suspension caused irreparable harm to aid groups and lacked rational justification. And he ordered all work to resume. So there's this legal spat that's going on right now between this judge and the Trump administration, along with all these states, which I think is something that we all expected that this was going to be occurring, right? Trump, since then, has resisted compliance. And he has terminated 90% of USAID contracts. and about 5,800 awards, which are worth about $60 billion. And he suspended thousands more contracts. So where we currently stand in this right now is on February 25th, we had Judge Ali ordered a deadline of midnight February 26th for a release of $2 billion in back pay to these people. Trump filed an emergency appeal to the Supreme Court hours before that deadline, and Chief Justice Roberts issued a pause on the judge's order. Roberts then requested a response from the plaintiffs, which is the 22 states, the aid groups, et cetera, by noon February 28th. So this is probably, you know, that deadline is happening basically as we're recording the podcast right now. And this is going to decide if the Supreme Court is going to hear the case formally or not, and if Trump's freeze should persist. So that's kind of where we're currently standing on the USAID stuff. My suspicion is Trump is going to win this, but I don't know.
It depends on the details, right? And so, and just so I can steel man the opposition a little bit here. So Congress has the power of the purse. What that's meant in its exercising of the power of the purse in Article 1 has meant that Congress is the one who says where money goes. And what it's spent on. It's the executive branch's responsibility to execute based upon statutory code. So that's the laws that they pass to guide, okay, this money is spent on this. But within that, there's relatively broad executive authority where the statute's not clear, right? So if it's just the billions of dollars to USAID for USAID work, then he has relative leeway to be able to say, well, that program's not working in this program, and I'm going to cancel these programs. I mean, or this, the other side of that is the Administrative Procedures Act, which is, and the Impoundment Control Act. Both of those, what they do is they regulate how the executive can make decisions. Administrative Procedures Act has things to do with like public comment periods and basically checks to make sure that that decisions on executive actions aren't done for political purposes, but rather done in alignment to statutory code. And then there's the last part is that the impoundment, and that was, and people already know this probably, but it was implemented under Nixon administration in order to try to exercise more direct control over executive priorities where Congress is unclear. And it's kind of a, you know, I don't know to where I fall on it exactly. I have allegiance to the Constitution, of course, so I tend to feel like the power of the purse is important. But when it's also Congress's responsibility to be very clear about where money is going and where it should be spent, if they want that money spent. And if it's unclear, it seems like it's the executive's prerogative to make sure it aligns with, you know, American interests.
Actually, I was just, as you were talking, Dave, I was just looking and it looks like, yeah, the deadline had just occurred. So there was some.
Yeah, it occurred like probably right when we started recording.
Yeah, the conclusion. I just pulled up the Supreme Court docket. The court should lift the administrative stay and deny the application. Respondents respectfully request that the court act as quickly as possible to lift the administrative stay, so as to prevent ongoing irreparable harm to respondents and the communities that depend on their work.
Meanwhile, it's a good defense of the deep state, right? It's all the people who are going to suffer if we don't get American tax dollars. And there might be true that there are some of these contracts are purely charitable work, but I'm very skeptical.
Well, yeah, because
I think it's up to them to prove it's not, right? At this point, like there should be a thorough review here, and you know, I think the quick action is justifiable because of all the abuses we've seen.
The major nonprofits that were involved in this case are AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition and Global Health Council. So this is one of those things too, right? Is that with the USAID thing, and this is the, you know, this is the thing that they're going to constantly point at, is like there is probably some good work that is coming out of USAID, like some beneficial things that are helping people, right? And that is the concern that is coming from the judge here. You know, I mean, the judge, it's a DC judge, obviously it's political, but the concern being raised is,
That's what they're saying the concern is.
The concern being raised is the blanket sweep, right? Like, that's the concern being raised, right? But
the so-called like judicial injury here is that people aren't going to receive funds that they were promised. I'm sympathetic to that, but God damn it, we're broke. You know, I also get that side of it, right? And we're spending all this money we don't have.
Help,
right? And that's not. There's also the good government question.
Yeah, and there's an aspect there too. If the penalties here is that the government is supposed to pay some back pay for the relief, like for the damages done by this executive order, fine. Like, we're saving so much money by canning all of these things, and people should probably get paid what is owed to them. If there's like contracts involved, et cetera, yada, yada, yada. Right. Like, I'm fine with that. That makes sense to me. Like, but yeah.
Yeah. This might be a more costly way to go about it. This might be a more costly way to go about it, but it's been effective in drawing attention to the problem. It's very difficult to get people riled up about spending. That's just reality. Conservatives have been grappling with this for 100 years now. And the scandal of it has been important to doing it. So paying some more money up front might make it worth it rather than, obviously in the hypothetical world, they do a big analysis and then they go to Congress and they say, we no longer need appropriations for these things. They don't make any sense in a big document, and maybe it gets a splash then. But this approach, the kind of break stuff and see what happens approach, has also been very effective, even if maybe costly up front.
Well, and you kind of raised a point there, is it's hard to get people riled up about spending. And I would like to point out what's been going on with Thomas Massie, because on the GOP budget resolution, he was the only Republican to vote against the raise, which is a bit disheartening. You know, Thomas Massie's always kind of the lone wolf in Congress who's going against these things. You know, I'm reminded of things like the CARES Act, where he went against everybody on the CARES Act. And, you know, I think in hindsight, it looks like Thomas Massie was probably 100% right.
What did Trump call him after that?
A third-rate politician that needs to be primaried out. But then Trump came along and endorsed him in his primary. I think Thomas won that one. But
yeah, and will he win on this one? I mean, the trick about spending resolutions and this madness is it's still not appropriate budget process, right? I mean, we're still not passing the 13 bills you need to pass in order to actually fund the government appropriately. Congress is currently controlled by Republicans. They could pass that bill. They could actually pass that. The Senate had a robust debate on this with Rand Paul doing kind of a mini filibuster on it to make the point that, you know, this is irresponsible and not what we promised the voters. So, you know, if you can get a mandate like this from Trump, you know, you would think that you would be able to go through a process that would actually cut the government's and cut government spending so you can afford the tax cuts you want. The real tax, to be clear, 100%, absolutely clear, the real tax is spending. The real tax is not taxation, right? Because if you don't bring in enough money to afford your spending, then you're going to inflate the rest. And then taxation and inflation is a circuitous way to tax people, especially the poorest, the heaviest.
But tariffs, Dave. Tariffs are solving everything.
It sounds like you're just the mouthpiece of Elon here. He says all government spending is taxation, coming from Elon Musk right here. I appreciate Elon for highlighting Thomas Massie here, saying, you know, we're living in a strange world where it's just like people care if Elon Musk says it. So like, it's just like, I'm glad that he tends to highlight the correct things.
Yeah.
Elon says all government spending is taxation. This point really needs to be hammered home. Whatever is not directly taxed is taxed in the form of inflation as the government prints more money. Inflation is the worst tax of all, as it punishes those who are just barely making ends meet or have gathered some savings.
Seems like Project 2025, if they were going to really do the work right, they would have came in January with here's what the budget should be, and then start working with appropriations to pass an appropriate budget. Now, I assume this resolution is because there's a debt ceiling coming up or something like that they are trying to do a stopgap so they don't have a government shutdown discussion. That would probably be a bad thing. So they still have time to go through an appropriate budget process, get that through so that we can actually pass one next year.
They won't.
That actually lays out a plan to actually get to, you know, a responsibly sized government for, you know, at least budgetary purposes.
Yeah, as much as I love a good government shutdown, it is bad optics. And it would be something that would really stifle.
It would slow things down. All it would do is just create, you know, less momentum. And a big part of this is maintaining momentum.
Yeah, that is true. And that's the unfortunate thing that I think Massey kind of area that Massey finds himself in is, you know, he's got his ideological bent, which I agree with. But there is the momentum problem. And unfortunately, we kind of exist where there's a political expediency to be able to get other things done. That exists within this argument. I actually want to bring up a video from Thomas where he was.
I like you in the first names with all these people. Donald, Thomas.
Well, you should notice Thomas and I are Twitter mutuals. You can see he follows
that
me.
That is
there,
true.
So, we're on a first name basis.
Basically besties.
Yeah, we're besties. Me and Thomas.
Hanging out in the hot tub together.
Get him on the fucking podcast then.
It is funny because he followed me because I commented under something saying, man, Thomas is looking so Chad lately. and he liked it and followed me because of it. And it's like, when you see this video, he is looking extra Chad. He got the facial hair.
Yeah, the beard. Like, it's the beard, you know, and small aside, but one of the best things that happened in politics in the last year has been the reintroduction of beards for men in politics. It's just J.D. Vance, Thomas Massey leading the way on men's aesthetic choices.
Did they?
Well done.
Wasn't
I support?
Did Crenshaw not have one? Not that he's my.
He doesn't count.
Yeah, not that I'm like wanting to follow him in any way, but like, I feel like I got
Crenshaw might have made it cool, unfortunately, because he was a Republican darling at one point.
Yeah, Republican bearded pirate.
Mm-hmm. Bearded pirate. and it's worth mentioning, too. Like, I don't think we ever talked about it on the podcast, but like Thomas Massey did have his wife die a few months ago, too. And like, it's pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah, especially after you hear his conversation on Tucker, like over the summer.
Yeah,
that was tough. I felt really bad.
Yeah, where he's just like talking about building his crazy house in Kentucky with his wife, like for a long time. Yeah, Thomas Massey definitely. I mean, he's always been my favorite congressman. You know, you have Thomas Massey in the House and Rand Paul in the Senate. But here is him being asked about his no vote, and we can hear from the horse's mouth.
Yeah. Can you just talk to us? Are you still a no? Is there anything?
They convinced me in there. I'm a no.
Is there anything?
Look, let me, their own numbers. If the Republican plan passes under the rosiest assumptions, which aren't even true, we're going to add $328 billion to the deficit this year. We're going to add $295 billion to the deficit the year after that.
Where's ours?
And $242 billion to the deficit after that, under the rosiest assumptions. Why would I vote for that?
So are you solidly a no?
Yeah, they convinced me. I was a lean no until this meeting. Not a no.
This no confirmed.
This is a no.
Why? What? Why?
They're talking points. Look. These are not something I made up. This is from. This is the leadership.
They're talking points.
It adds $328 billion to the deficit. It adds $295 billion to the deficit the year after that. If the only way they get to this magic thing where it's not going to kill our country is 5 years from now, they imagine that 2.5% growth
when he said that.
Accumulates. And that even right here, they say they're going to cap discretionary spending. You think we're going to cap discretionary spending and then spend at the rate of inflation after that? That has never happened. So their assumptions are wrong. But even if you take their assumptions at face value, they told us in there they're going to increase the deficit in 2025 by $328 billion. And I've been here long enough. I've been here 12 years. So I've seen a 10-year plan or two come all the way to 10 years. Under Boehner, we had these 10-year plans. Under Ryan, we had these 10-year plans. Anything past the third year never happens.
Mr. Speaker, will the budget
review that is absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And actually what we're looking at here is a lot of those will be based upon economic growth projections and receipt projections based upon current tax rates. So imagine for a moment that you assume the rosiest picture of there's no elasticity at all in tariffs from China. The economy is going to grow by 3 or 4%. And then you start cutting USAID dollars, and all of a sudden enough USAID dollars are cut that we actually suffer a minor recession due to just the slowdown of the velocity of money. And that's how much money of USAID dollars are running around the United States. Possible, right? And there's in some indication today that might be true from Zero Hedge. So, I mean, they're absolutely right. Balance in a year, actually take some austerity, actually, you know, do your duty, actually fulfill a promise to your voters, and then ride it out for a year as things equalize. And by next election cycle, you're going to be hot again. I mean, I just don't, the lack of courage from these guys is astounding.
Mm. Yeah. And we have our debt badge. As you can see, Thomas is wearing his, and it's even signed by Thomas Massey right there.
Hell yeah, brother.
Yeah. Hell yeah, brother. We're sitting at $36 trillion, and it just keeps going up and up and up. I don't know if the camera can...
Yeah, it's not focused.
Yeah, no.
But,
nah, you can't see it.
What did he say it was going to have? $380 billion?
I think, according to his tweet, we have, just because that's directly what's in front of me, he's saying the GOP budget resolution that passed the House this week increases the debt limit from $36 trillion to $40 trillion and spends enough dollars to increase the debt from $36 trillion to $56 trillion over the next 10 years. But yay for tax cuts. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is the spending is a tax, and people got to continue to realize that. I this is always the concern when a Republican comes into office is that government spending just all of a sudden doesn't become a priority anymore. That's always the concern that exists there. And
yeah, Trump spent a lot on his first term, didn't he?
Every president always spends more than the previous one. Oh, every single one.
It's a good precedent.
Yeah. It's just kind of the norm.
Well, and this was always the biggest, the most credible critique of Trump was that even before COVID, he was spending like crazy, uninterested in spending questions and wanted tax cuts. And then he said, well, if we cut taxes, even though revenue went up, they still didn't even manage to, you know, level off spending. They kept spending more and more. And especially in this area, what we're talking about here is non-discretionary spending, meaning spending that are obligations that have been promised. You have to do systemic reform in order to tackle those. We can't balance the budget on just non-discretionary spending, probably. So, you know, it was going to require a tremendous amount of courage and work to actually break that bubble and cut the budget when it comes to these discretionary issues.
Well, that
does, non-discretionary
that issues, does raise the thing because some of what Doge has been doing has been trying to cut into that, right? Like trying to sift through all the fraud. We have the with the Social Security, you had like the person that's older than the country, right? Mm-hmm. And that, I can't remember, what was the number? How many billions of dollars would this be saving if all those people are purged from the thing, right? Oh, so there are those ways of trying to begin to tackle on there, but like Doge just has a lot of work to cut out. I know Elon publicly
the challenge is Article 1, though.
Yeah.
Well, the challenge is Article 1, though. Congress has the power of the purse. So, like, if they don't want to tackle it, it's not going to get tackled. Like, that's the reality. They're just going to keep sending money until they're just like, we're sitting on a pile of cash, and then you have problems with impoundment control. So, like, you know, like it would be nice to see some amount of from the Republican leadership some actual addressing of this issue. Right? Well, they campaign on it every year,
and that's the thing is Thomas. I've heard him say on podcasts in the past where you know the unfortunate reality is that the voters are kind of the problem here because they keep voting in the people that are willing to continue to increase the spending and just spend like mad. And you need to have a massive shift in voter psychology around this. And that's one of the things that I think is good on the Doge side is I feel like the Doge side, they are kind of changing the masses' psychology around government spending. Like slowly this is happening. Like Elon has been a very big factor in kind of changing the mental models of people around like who they're voting for. I think like mm-hmm. this was an argument I made on a podcast that I think it was just me, Dave, or me, Joe, and Bennett at one point with the idea of the paybacks for all the spending cuts that were happening, is that it actually kind of provides a bit of an incentive for people to rethink their evaluation of government spending and how much waste is going on and actually wanting to cut mm-hmm. in there. I think that's one kind of benefit there. You know, Joe was raising the, like, we should just put it all back towards the debt because it's, yeah. But yeah. I think that there's a few different angles that you can take.
Yeah,
that,
I just think,
that.
I don't know. I think incentive is a strong motive. Like,
yeah, follow the incentives and you'll see the future, right?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think people...
Well, it's smart politics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just think people for are sure. going to be less incentivized by, like, look, we're paying the debt down versus, like, look, you could get a couple $1,000
yeah.
every so often. Mm-hmm.
If we can, like, continue to cut out all the waste from
yeah,
abuse.
Like, yeah. Perfect world. I'd love to just eliminate the debt. But I don't know. That's... People aren't... It's not the sexy option, basically.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Dave?
Sorry. No, I was only going to say that there's... It's smart politics, but there's also a really great... there's making it to be a thing that the executive can do that then changes the culture, so then it reinforces the other way. But, you know, these leadership... actually matters, right? And why this is only one versus all of them, as opposed to 2 years ago, or even a year ago, where you had the 13 versus everybody, and they were able to swing the vote to try to get concessions out of the Biden administration, the Democrats, and the establishment Republicans, was because now we have the Republican, pillar of Trump, and people saying, well, this is the Trump budget. He's endorsed it, so I'm for it, right? And until Trump prioritizes that, we're not going to see that in the Congress. If he said I'm gonna veto anything that doesn't balance within a year or 2 years or 3 years, we're not gonna it's not gonna happen. Yeah. That these Republicans will only do it if they have Trump's cover. Until he prioritizes that, it's not gonna happen. And I don't think we should be holding our breaths on him doing that. He wants to operate in the fantasy world where we're just gonna outgrow the debt. Mm-hmm. When the debt right now is how much? What's the annual budget deficit right now? It's over $800 billion. It's almost $1 trillion, right?
Yeah, I don't know exactly with exactly the numbers, but that sounds correct to me. Yeah, that's the yeah. You know, there is a good point there where is the Trump strategy is just like a pure growth strategy, and that's I think that's a useful one variable to the strategy. Like yeah. The growth strategy yeah, sure. is good as a variable, but there's more stuff that's going on.
Well, and growth would be amplified as demonstrated in the depression of 1919. Growth is amplified when you actually balance the budget.
Yeah.
We were running a budget deficit. We cut back on budget deficit. We deregulated, we desocialized, and we saw enormous growth. There was a recession and we popped out of the recession under 6 months and we're all of a sudden we're the roaring 20s. Mm-hmm. So this is definitely doable. It's just the courage to actually say no, all right? And it's hard to look at a guy like Donald Trump and be like, well, he really understands how you can cut back on spending in order to become more wealthy. Like that's not his ethos at all. It's been take loans and make bets. Right. And he right now he justifies it. He says, well, if you look at the assets of the country, we're not in that far of debt. Well, those assets include my house. That's not your asset. That's my asset. You know, it includes all the public lands. What's he going to do? Sell them off? You could use them as collateral. He's going to take bets against your fishing hole that you like to go to. I don't think so. So like
imagine using the public lands as collateral. That's just like that concept to me. I never really thought about that, but that's just a funny concept to me.
He's doing.
Well, as we come to close out on this week in news, how's things going on the Defend the Guard stuff, Dave?
Yeah, we got a hearing, went fantastic. The volunteers who came in told very compelling stories. We had an incredible legal defense from Dan and Darren Gobb and others. We're coming up. Executive action is probably going to be this afternoon. So right after I'm done here, I'm going to go back up to the Capitol and start shaking hands again and talk to people some more. We have a pathway. We just got a lot of squishy Democrats who are afraid to go our way, just out of the optics and out of, you know, just the fear of being seen collaborating with Republicans. So if we can overcome that, we should be able to get out of committee and get to the floor.
I'd be curious on Defend the Guard. For those that don't know, Defend the Guard, we've talked about it a lot on the podcast. But
we also had Dan McKnight
literally just last episode.
So take a listen to that.
Yeah, but you know, yeah. Overall, just giving the power back to the states, where Congress has to declare war in order for the National Guard to be utilized. What is the something I'd be curious is, what is the current party makeup here in Montana on that? Is like, is it kind of just like a bunch of Republicans are for, a bunch of Republicans are against, and then same thing on the Democrat side?
Yeah,
like, it's not really a partisan breakdown. Like, yeah, a lot of things would be.
Well, I mean, the overwhelming base of support is constitutional Republicans, conservative Republicans, right? Who look at it and say, you know, there might be risks here with federal blowback, but the Constitution is the law of the land and they have to obey the Constitution. And when you look into it and you dig into the actual text and you dig into the enabling language of Title 32, it becomes really clear that we're just asking the government to the federal government to live it up to its side of the bargain that it cut in 1903 and 1933 when it created the National Guard. The real blowback is just this. It's politicized. It was kind of weaponized between sessions this last time around. We have a more moderate Republican outfit overall this year. That's partially because of redistricting. And it's also because, you know, some conservatives did lose their primaries this last time around. And one of the talking points was this whole defund the guard narrative that has been generated by, you know, people who are interested in trying to just defeat conservatives so they can get more moderate sense so they can grow government. And then on the Democrat side, it's kind of, you kind of got like old school pro peace Democrats and progressives that are, you know, more leftist than liberal. And they're friendly to the bill, want to see it pass and stuff like that. It's just a matter for all involved with it comes to courage and wrapping your mind around something that's difficult for legislators to never wrap their minds around, which is federal code and how these things interrelate, what we're going to pass to, how it's going to relate, and then how will the federal government react? That's why a big part of the discussion after the hearing, you know, during the hearing was, well, who supports this on the federal level? And we had the Adjutant General of Montana get up and just lie to the committee and say, yeah, Tim Sheehy, he didn't really support it. He just said so.
I was going to reference that one.
And he then, said that when he was some Fox News guy.
Yeah. I was going to reference that. And then three people in the hearing all like, we're like, actually, Tim Sheehy endorse it here, like in person, like at this event that we were all at on camera. That was a great clip.
Yeah, largely thanks to our boy Liam.
Vice Chair Metz was literally the guy that asked him. You know, Vice Chair, like the guy sitting next to the chair was the guy that asked him, Sheehy, hey, will you support Defend the Guard?
Yeah.
Before he said 100%. So, I mean, it was bad strategy.
Before we close out, I want to show you guys one video. There's a video that popped up on my timeline, and it's a great way to close out the show.
To play us out?
Yeah, to play you guys out. Here. I'm not even going to give you guys context. I'm just going to let you see it in its entirety.
Okay.
The people that came out wanting us to justify our jobs with five things we did last week was on Saturday night.
Yeah.
And I was literally working on Saturday night to make up for all the distractions I had had the previous week, which came from the executive branch. And so I'm working, trying to catch up on things. And then I get that email on top of it. It's very hard to keep your train of thought when you're getting threatened and harassed like that. The email that came out wanting us to just.
Is this lady ever had a job before? Is this her first one? Like, this is the first time?
Just a little bit of updates on where Doge is right now. I do find it hilarious to me that Elon, which is a common thing that he just does in his business practices, where he'll just randomly send out these emails to everybody and just be like, hey, tell me what the five things were that you did this week. And everybody has to like respond, mm-hmm. like, these are the cool things that I'm working on. And that's just all you got to do, which isn't going to take much time. Like, that's just like, oh, yeah, I was working on something. Here's what I did, right? And all these government employees being like, I am traumatized. My flow is disrupted in my workflow.
Check them out of the muse. I think my favorite part of Doge so far is that Joy Reid got fired.
But
yeah, MSNBC doesn't have those USAID numbers coming in. Yeah. They got to cut back someplace, right? Yeah,
it's a good thing we have new media getting all the binders, you know.
Yeah.
What additional note? I like how she says all this stuff, all these distractions, you know, to my work from the executive branch. Mm-hmm. Lady, you work for the executive branch. You are the executive branch. You mean from the executors that you're supposed to be working from?
Your boss.
Just imagine, like, you're working for, you know, John Deere, and they're like, hey, what did you work on this week? And you're like, I can't believe these guys are asking me.
I can't believe Mr. John Deere would have the audacity.
What are we doing?
Yeah, getting upset at your boss for asking them, for them asking you to do your job is pretty.
Or just like, hey, update me on how's your job doing going right now? Update me on it.
Don't get me wrong. I would appreciate it as an employee if that was a Friday morning email, not a Saturday night. But that said, this lady didn't even have the excuse of I was on the ski hill or something, or I was out doing something. She has, I was working on Saturday night. Like,
yes, just tell me about it. Yeah, what are you working on?
She easily could have. She could have put that interview into an email.
Actually would have been better in an email.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's our show for this week. Thank you so much for joining in on us. Please give us a like, comment, tell us about how are you feeling about phase one of the Epstein rollout?
Tell us what you're working on.
Tell us, what have you been working on?
What are you working on this week? Comment below.
Comment
five
below.
Five things you did this week.
Before we go, Dave, good luck with Defend the Guard. Enjoying watching all stuff on Twitter and everything that you guys are doing. So good luck. Keep us posted.
Appreciate it, fellas.
Yep. All right. Cool.
Take care.
Peace, guys. Thank you so much, everyone. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.